results from the original.
Oh. Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, you?
Never any better there be.
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness for Thursday, March 19th, to order. First item of business is going to be a public hearing on House Bill 3303. I'll open the public hearing on that House bill. Mr. Administrator, if you would.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3303 expands disadvantaged enterprise certification to service-disabled veteran-owned businesses, requires annual report to the governor, director of Oregon Business Development Department, and Legislative Assembly, declares an emergency effective on passage. There may be a fiscal or revenue impact. A statement has not been issued. There's a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Consumer Protection, Government Effectiveness, and you have before you proposed -2 amendments clarifying some language on the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. So first, Representative Gomberg, are you going to come up? And is Lori or Cameron, are you coming up with Representative Gomberg?
What bill is it?
Needless to say, just please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. Very pleased to be here with you today on this measure. Some of you may know that over the course of several months, I was involved with weekly meetings last summer on a task force dealing with small business procurement with the state of Oregon and looking for opportunities for different kinds of smaller businesses to bid on and receive state contracts. And we looked at that issue from a number of different perspectives, what kind of opportunities were there, how we could reduce barriers, how we could provide incentives. And as we looked at the kind of companies that were eligible for preferential treatment, we saw women-owned businesses, we saw minority-owned businesses, we saw emerging small businesses, but consistently hovering in the room was the fact that that there was an omission, and that omission was veteran-owned businesses. And so we put together, just following that task force, a correction, a course correction, if you will, that would include veterans in that preferential opportunity process. Now, I will tell you that at the time we drafted the bill, we specified disabled veterans. And over the course of conversations later on, there was some discussion about whether that should be broadened to include all veteran-owned businesses. I have no problem with that. Let me make it clear. We crafted the bill initially. There was some follow-up discussion, and I will leave it to you and your greater wisdom as to whether you'd like to broaden the process from beyond the limitation to disabled veterans. There are some amendments before you. They are mostly administrative tweaks. I think the most substantive of them is that we started out with an enterprise that was very difficult to pronounce because it involved minorities, women, and emerging small businesses, and now we want to add a V to it. And we just simply couldn't come up with anything that that covered all those bases and was easy enough to pronounce. And so I think that the work group that gathered together came up with the Certification Office for Business and Inclusion and Diversity, the COBID office, and that was the compromise that that you will see in the measure before you, in addition to a number of other administrative tweaks. So that's what I wanted to share with you, and I'll turn at this point to my wingman, who can fill in a lot of the gaps.
Thank you, Representative.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And the good honorable gentleman to my right happens to be the co-chair of our subcommittee on Ways and Means that ODVA's budget flows through. So, of course, I am in favor of his sponsored legislation. But fortunately, it is a good concept. House Bill 3303 formalizes the process behind the certification of service-disabled veteran-owned businesses. Through this committee and on the Senate side and through the legislature in years past, we have had this authority for agencies and public employers and public entities to contract, to give preference in contracting to service-disabled veteran-owned businesses, but we have not had that process in terms of who's making sure that they, in fact, do pass the certification test, that they are then on a list that we can measure and track these outcomes. So this simply embeds that process within the existing Business Oregon process and with the governor's office, Equity Lens, and their office. So just happy to be here and answer any questions.
Any questions of either one of these witnesses? Representative Escobo?
Yes, is there in this bill, I can't seem to find anything, is there a sunset on this bill? Because if we take something out for a spin, we should take it out for a spin and check on it.
Chair Lively, Representative Escobar, I don't think it does, but it's not significant. They're relatively
irrelevant.
Minor changes to existing programs, but I don't believe it has an
existing
sunset.
I understand that, but I mean, what if we, well, I guess what I'm saying is, if we expand this to all veterans, maybe we ought to, I don't know, I guess it wouldn't matter, really. Yeah.
So, if I have this correct, Representative Gomberg, it currently as written is disabled veterans, but there's been some conversation about expanding it to all veterans.
That's correct,
and
Mr.
that's
Chair.
Something, as you indicated, I think that you'd leave it to the committee to decide if we wanted to. And so maybe, Representative Escobar, at that point, we'd have that conversation.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
But I mean, I don't, the more I think about it, the more relevant it is. Doesn't matter.
Sure. Other questions, Representative Parrish?
Yes, thanks. Well, you know, I'd actually support expanding it to all veterans for the strict purpose that, you know, as a woman and a minority and a business owner that, you know, who could access that office with my company, I'm not limited by whether or not I have a disability. So I would want us to see us make sure that we're not then creating two classes of veterans. If we're going to apply it, I think we should apply it across the board. Just my two bits.
Thank you. Anything else, these witnesses? Okay. Thank
right.
you very much. Thanks
Thank you very much,
back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you.
So next we'll call on Mark Houshay. Is that right? Houshay?
Houshay, yes, sir.
Houshay. Okay. Supposed to say it faster.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Houshay, and I work for the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs Communications Team. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 3303 that provides certification for service-disabled veterans in the procurement process with the Oregon Business Development Department. This concept for the bill really started during the planning process for our first-ever veteran-owned business opportunity showcase that happened last fall. This was a collaborative partnership with ODVA, Department of Administrative Services, Oregon Business Development Department, ODOT, and the Governor's Office, and also with Representative Gomberg to look at putting together a conference that would reach out to veteran business owners. So in June of last summer, or last year, the federal VA reached out to the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs and encouraged us to host a conference or a showcase, if you will, that would allow veteran business owners to have business opportunities and the opportunity to procure with state and federal government. When we were presented with this idea, we immediately saw the potential to reach out to a very specific veteran business owner community. And we recognized that we couldn't do this on our own. And so our first step was we reached out to several different agencies, Department of Administrative Services, Business Oregon, Secretary of State's Business Express, the Governor's Office of Economic and Business Equity, ODOT, the Small Business Administration, as well as all their small business development centers. With that, we created a stakeholder group to help begin planning this concept, really the business experts in the state, to start planning this event and how we could best reach out to those veterans. So from July through September of last year, this 12-member stakeholder group began working together, and we created a veteran-focused curriculum and agenda for this conference. And with that, we wanted to make sure that it was effective and relevant for the veterans. So we called it the Veteran Business-Owned Opportunity Showcase, and it's become known as VOBO. So that's the acronym that everybody knows it now. The curriculum we developed, we're very proud of. We used a three-path concept to address the different types of veterans that would come to an event like this. The first path was called START, and that was for veterans who wanted to start their own business. Path two was called stability, and that was for new businesses who wanted to learn how to create stability with their existing business. And the third path was growth, and that was for well-established veteran-owned businesses who were ready to procure with the state or federal government. So when we first got ready to promote this event, because this was a new community that we were reaching out to for veterans, we weren't sure what the response was going to be. within 1 month of us opening up registration, we had over 180 veteran-owned businesses that had signed up to attend. We reached our maximum capacity and had to shut down registration for this event. So that confirmed our theory that there's a tremendous number of current and prospective veteran business owners looking for information, assistance, resources, and business opportunities. We hosted the event at Camp Withycombe on October 17th of last year and included structured networking sessions, resource tables, and our training classes that were geared on those three paths, which starting a business, already have a business, or want to grow in your business once you're well established. One of the great things about the event was Representative Gomberg was our keynote speaker there. And we were able to connect veteran business owners with Representative Gomberg in relation to this bill. So he was able to connect directly with them and provide that input from veteran business owners here in the state of Oregon. Phobos was an overwhelming success for many reasons. One of the key reasons was all of the federal and state agencies that were involved in this, we were able to reach out in unison to a demographic that has not been reached out to yet for veterans. Another thing we're very proud of is the curriculum that we developed has now been adopted by the federal VA as the standard and template for the rest of the states to use to hold Veteran Business Opportunity Showcase, the Path 1, 2, and 3 concept, as well as the design of the conference. So we're very proud of that. Also, the partnership and statewide collaboration for this event allowed us to create something meaningful and relevant for the veterans. Those partnerships continue today through one of the outreaches called Connect to Oregon that's hosted and funded by ODOT, Business Oregon, and DAS, where they go out to communities and connect with county and city governments. And at those events, veterans are able to connect with those opportunities on a local level. Because of our event now, veterans are being reached out to at those events. Also, with Representative Gomberg's support, was extremely appreciated at the conference because veterans were able to reach out and connect directly with him to provide input for this measure. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions if you have them.
Sorry, thank you. Any questions? Representative Evans.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for doing what evidently is a great program. I just want to clarify, the feds approached ODVA about doing this at first?
Representative Chair Lively, Representative Evans. Yes, basically, this is a new endeavor that the federal VA is looking at, and they looked at some of the top states in the country and came to ODVA to see if we'd be willing to do this. Our VOBUS was the second one only in the country to have happened.
I just want to give credit where we beat up the USVA a lot, so I just want to make sure they got one right. And then the second thing is really more of a technical question of how is GCAP a part of this or not?
Chair Lively, Representative Evans, GCAP was one of our stakeholder groups. They played a big role in that. They work also with the federal VA, but they're also in partnership with the Oregon Business Development Department.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any way of tracking, or could you tell us today if you know the number of contracts that have actually been received by these veteran businesses through the process? Sounds like you've been successful in connecting dots, but have those relationships then evolved into actual contracts?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, because there's no certification process for the veterans, it's very difficult to track what contracts were given to veterans since there's currently not a process for that. But with the event, we had over 200 veteran businesses respond. And with these Connect to Oregon events, you're starting to see more and more input from that. So I think as we go on with this measure, that's something we'll definitely be able to provide in the future.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for presenting. Sure. Okay, next up we have, looks like, is it G.D. Bryson? Byron? Close?
We're up here, but I don't have anything to say, it's all right.
Oh, okay. How about Anthony Sweeney?
Good afternoon, Chair Lively. Committee members. My name is Anthony Sweeney. I'm a Marine Corps veteran and service-connected disabled veteran. And right now I work for a construction firm. We are a certified emerging small business, so I see the benefits of having a certified firm. There's different entities with Metro. They have the shelter marketplace where only the certified firms can participate. And having the classification for a veteran-owned business will be able to help veteran businesses grow and be able to participate in these certain shelter marketplaces. And working with bigger general contractors, most contracts have a certain percentage that they want to meet with disadvantaged businesses. And now they can pursue veteran-owned businesses and be able to grow. Because with a lot of businesses, with emerging small business, there is an expiration date. So then after that, you can't participate anymore. But I do see the benefit of having a veteran-owned business and talking with different entities to have it all veterans and not just disabled. Because you're excluding veterans that didn't participate in wartime and they did not have a classification. So doing that, you'll alienate some veterans that, and they'll feel like they're being left out. But I do see a benefit in this bill, and I approve the House Bill 3303. And thank you. And any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Sweeney?
Just a comment. Thanks for serving.
Kevin. Thank you very much for coming and testifying. Is there anybody else here who wishes to speak to House Bill 3303? Okay. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3303. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2426. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2426 updates language defining in statute current 911 emergency systems in keeping with developments in communication technologies. There may be a fiscal and revenue impact. No statement issued. There's no subsequent referral.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. I'm Dave Stecky. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department, and with me today is...
Good afternoon. I'm Mark Tennyson with the Office of Emergency Management, and I'm also the manager of the state 911 program.
Good afternoon. I'm Karen Johnson from the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
Just by way of intro, we certainly appreciate the opportunity for the hearing of 2426, Chair Lively and members of the committee. From our standpoint, this was our legislation. This was our concept that we pushed forward. What this is in a very simplistic way is basically a change in the definitions and authorities of what needs to occur in order to accommodate future technologies in support of the PSAP community. What we're looking at here is not necessarily quantity, but quality. I know it's a thick bill. It has a lot of different changes to it in terms of what we're trying to get accomplished. But what we have here is technology embedded inside statute. And when technology is embedded inside statute, when technology changes, we're going to have to make a lot of changes to accommodate that. And that's what this is really about. It's about the future technologies in support of the PSAP community. We can call it next generation. We can call it whatever you want. What we're calling it, what we like to call it, is emergency services communications. And then that way, from a technology agnostic standpoint, it's going to cover the umbrella, because who the heck knows what's going to be 10 years from now. And we would prefer not to come back here in 10 years with another weighty House bill to cover that concept. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mark Tennyson.
Well, good afternoon. Again, Mark Tennyson with the Office of Emergency Management. Chair Lively, members of the committee, last year approximately 1.6 million 911 calls were made in the state of Oregon. However, our current statewide 911 system relies on a very outdated network, which is near end of life and developed more than 40 years ago. The Frame Relay Network, which provides 911 callers' physical location information, is nearing end of life for support and maintenance by the provider, CenturyLink. The end of support date is June 30th, 2017. After this date, the current analog network, as we know it, cannot be supported by any vendor. This does not mean that the 911 emergency reporting system will cease to function. What it does mean is that when the equipment fails, circuits and routers, for example, there will be no replacement available. Under the direction of the governor's December 1st, 2014 proposed budget, OEM is working with the Department of Administrative Services, Enterprise Technology Services, to start on their replacement of the Frame Relay Network by migrating to an Internet Protocol Network. Currently, the statute that governs 911 emergency services, ORS Chapter 403, strictly defines basic and enhanced 911 services and effectively limits the ability to reach 911 to voice calls only, based solely upon old mobile telephone technology. More importantly, the current statute does not authorize OEM to move the state forward to use for the use of any additional technology beyond a voice call to reach a public safety answering point. House Bill 2426 is intended to make the statute technology agnostic and give OEM the necessary authority to move the state into the future. House Bill 2426 is written in such a way to allow flexibility in the use of current technologies that cannot reach 911 today, such as text messaging, as well as future new technologies as they become available. House Bill 2426 does not impact the state's ability to complete the frame relay replacement project, but any technology beyond a voice call to reach a PSAP will require new statutory language. Other drivers for moving to a new digital IP network include public expectation for the ability to reach 911 in an emergency. The Americans with Disability Act, for example, has advocated for the deaf and hard of hearing community for years that the ability to reach 911 via text is paramount in an emergency. In addition to enabling other technologies besides voice calls to 911, one of the other components of the bill is it seeks to clarify, for example, OEM's authority to, in either direct paying or reimbursing PSAPs for qualified expenses out of the 911 enhanced account via the 911 tax. OEM and DOJ worked together with Legislative Council to draft House Bill 2426, held several meetings last year, June through October of last year. After the bill came out, there were a few suggested revisions that we've noticed, primarily just some cleanup, friendly amendments, as we call them, with some cleanup, and we will be working on providing those in the form of an amendment as we work with Leg Council on that. This concludes my testimony today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Do you have
Chair Lively? She's here to help answer questions. She's been our counsel in regards to NextGen and telecommunications emergency services for some time, and quite frankly, because of the technology and the nature of this, we needed a couple of lawyers to help us figure it out.
I'm sure. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, whatever you call it, sounds good. More technology, always the better. The question I have, though, is how does this transition from Dialine or Dialine Plus or whatever it is to over IP impact franchise fees and the resourcing for the PSAPs, or does it?
Do you want to address that a little? Franchise fees?
Chair Lively. Representative Evans, this bill is not going to impact the funding at all relative to what's happening. So the same funding, the franchise fees, those will be covered under different statutes for the PUC. So that won't affect what's happening here. This 911 is based on the 911 tax.
But electrons are now going to be going over IP instead of sound waves over an infrastructure network. So there's not going to be any change anywhere?
If I could, Chair Lively, Representative Evans, this is going to allow us to enter into future projects for next generation. So if you're asking the question, what is it going to cost us to implement what we call next gen tomorrow? We don't know, because that's going to be a project that's going to be based upon DAS and CIO legislative approval. This is a policy discussion that allows us to actually go into that project. Okay. But the actual cost and the definition of what that project is and how much it costs and who's going to do it is undetermined, because we don't have that project scope yet. Okay. And then go back to your other question in regards to the revenue distribution. There's no change in how the revenues are distributed to the PSAPs. We have a 911 tax. It goes four places, 4%, up to 4% admin for OEM, up to 1% Department of Revenue, 35% into an equipment account or enhanced account, and then 60% gets distributed to the PSAPs. And there's no change to that. And I would just like to highlight that what we believe is this entire bill is all about changing it to emergency services communications, technology agnostic, with that one clarifying point where it talked about, on page 15, where it talked about our authority and clarifying how we pay and reimburse. Everything else is just, do we have the ability to move to another technology beyond what we have now today?
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? The witnesses? Evidently not. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for presenting it. Certainly. Thank you for being here.
Anybody else who wishes to speak to House Bill 2426? Certainly. I don't think so, but you're certainly willing to just introduce yourself and make your comments.
House Bill 2426.
And your name for the record?
My name is Carlton Tilley.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman Lively, thank you, and committee members. This is a bill that I think that we actually need to lay out there and start exploring opportunities in the 911 system, because it is getting old and outdated, and we are coming up with more and more ways to communicate outside of cell phones. And I would be, as a private citizen, I am in support of this and exploratory. But also, you know, as we explore, as we all know, with IT projects that we get into, I think they should come back with at least some type of financial gap and says, we don't know yet. Well, they need to have a game plan to come back. That's just my sentiment there before we'd move forward. As we know, in Oregon, IT projects have a tendency to tank. And a critical 911 system does not need to tank. But the voice over IP is definitely a system I think that the state should explore. And we should give them the tools to be able to do that. So we are communicating in different ways, and ways that we communicate now from five years from now, in many ways will change. So that's all I got, and I thank the committee for the time.
Thank you very much for testifying. Anybody else? Okay. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2426. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2427. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2427 authorizes emergency services lighting for emergency management vehicles. There's no revenue impact. No subsequent referral may have a fiscal impact. Statement not yet issued.
Okay. Mr. Stuckey.
Good afternoon again, Chair Lively, members of the committee. I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. And with me today is?
My name is Matt Marhine. I'm for the record, Oregon Office of Emergency Management, Operation and Preparedness Section Manager.
Okay. House Bill 2427 is a legislative concept that was produced by the Office of Emergency Management while I was the director of OEM. This is basically a concept on behalf of emergency management throughout the state of Oregon to add or change how lights could be used in sirens for the emergency management profession. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Matt Marhine.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Chair Lively. Committee members. This particular bill is to really provide the capability for state, tribal, county, and city emergency management organizations throughout the state for and recognize them as responding disciplines authorized to utilize emergency lights and sirens during incidents of disaster and emergency response throughout the state. Adding this the specific disciplines of emergency management and emergency services to the already identified available disciplines that can use lights and sirens throughout the state allows us to increase visibility, response capabilities, and the safety of the emergency management discipline when doing functions such as damage assessment or communicating or transporting through the damage areas throughout the car communities. A prime example of this bill would allow the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management, a very close partner in this effort, to access these important safety measures for public alert and warning during that transportation through the communities. The intent is the utilization of red and amber lights, very clearly the red and amber lights only, and to make sure that it's only usable during emergency operations and field operational efforts during disaster events. OEM is currently working very closely with Oregon Department of Transportation, the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management, on the particular bill issues to ensure appropriate implementation of that legislative material. Outreach efforts are currently underway with Oregon State Police, the State Fire Marshal's Office, the State Sheriff's Association, and the Oregon Emergency Management Association to just increase awareness and additionally address possible implementation components. And this concludes my testimony, and I'm available for questions.
Okay. Any questions of this witness? Representative Evans, do you have?
I have a quick one.
Go ahead.
For some reason, I thought green was the color for emergency management on large-scale events. Is that not the deal?
Chair Lively, Representative Edmonds. Nationally, green is used for particular aspects of emergency management, such as CERT teams and other initiatives,
right.
But it's not related to emergency lighting aspects.
Okay, so follow up. Just a request for a friendly amendment, and mostly tongue-in-cheek. Do not let the Senate President get a light.
Oh.
Chair Lively, Representative Edmonds. That's going to be a policy decision that we're going to leave in your hands. I apologize.
Wise man.
And so from our standpoint, what we're looking at doing is to ensure that sure. emergency managers have the ability to move across. Many of them already have that. The county emergency managers are associated to law enforcement at the sheriff level. Some are not. Most city emergency managers are not. And so we just want to make certain that they have that ability in a red or amber status. We're not trying to turn them into cops. We're not trying to give them blue lights and be code across the city.
Very good. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Amy Joyce from ODOT. It's nice to see you, Amy, outside of the Transportation Committee.
Chair Lively and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and thank you, Chair. It's nice to see all of you in any area. And Representative Evans, I'll come to your office and regale you with stories of the Senate President driving one of our snow plows in a
work session. That must have been a treat.
So this bill 2427 involves the ability to run lights and sirens in emergency situations. So that's why we get to the red and the amber lights rather than green. The bill, as it came out drafted, is quite broad, and so I've been talking with the Department of Emergency Management about how we might amend that bill to get to the intent and work perhaps administratively as well to get to the intent rather than as broadly as it's drafted in terms of emergency management personnel. One thing to note, what's interesting, I think, in the statute is of the listed entities that can get this designation, you'll see the Director of Transportation can designate vehicles. What's interesting, though, is that's not just ODOT vehicles. That's any vehicle. And, in fact, among the administrative rules on this is a rule where the department restricts ourselves on how we can designate our own vehicles for emergency services. So we'll continue to work with the folks from Emergency Management and Mr. Stuckey and come to some amendments or administrative solution to get them to what they need.
Okay. Questions, Amy? So if I understand this correctly, at the end of the day, ODOT would administer or be responsible for overseeing the implementation. Is that how it works?
Well, Chair Lively, that would depend on the pleasure of the committee and how the bill comes out. If it were to be left as the statute as is, the administration is under the Department of Transportation. If you were to add in the provision as it sits on the base bill, the department would be completely out of it, and it would just be to the emergency service providers themselves.
Thank you. Any other questions for Amy? Okay, thank you very much. Let's see. One more person. Now, did I say it was GD? So is it GD? Is it Brian? Bryson?
Sir, I have to excuse myself being an idiot. I was under the impression it was an exciting end when I got here.
Oh, okay. No problem. No problem. Thank you. It is confusing. Thank you. Sure, certainly.
Chair Lively, for the record, I am David Blitzer. I'm the operations manager for the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. Thank you very much for my very brief opportunity to come speak with you. We are very much in support of this bill, and we worked with the state to actually start drafting the legislative concept and put the ideas together. We are a city bureau that is not under a law enforcement agency. We report to an executive, the mayor, and the council of Portland. So without this change, we wouldn't have the ability to use our vehicles as emergency vehicles. So with that, That's my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions? Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You bet. Anybody else who wishes to offer testimony on House Bill 2427? Okay. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2427. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2428. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2428 removes reference in statute to members of the Oregon State Defense Force as qualified emergency services volunteers as specified. There's no revenue or fiscal impact, and there's no subsequent referral.
Okay. Mr. Stuckey.
Good afternoon again, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Secchi. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department. Appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony on House Bill 2428. House Bill 2428 is an administrative action. This is an action about clarifying who pays and who is responsible for workers' comp. This has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the State Defense Force going away or not going away. This is about workers' compensation. The State Defense Force is in ORS 399.035. This is about making certain that the Oregon State Defense Force, when it gets activated and is stood up and is under state active duty, if there's an injury, it still is going to fall under the Oregon Military Department. It is an entity of the Oregon Military Department. And so that's what we're talking about, is a workers' comp action here, not the elimination of the State Defense Force. And so from our standpoint, this is a housekeeping. This is an initiative that we brought up, and we believe the bill is good as is. And in conclusion, I could answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, good explanation, because I was getting ready to blast you.
Sir.
This probably could have been written better, don't you think? The explanation that we're reading about what the bill was going to do.
Sir.
Because I read it to mean you were going to come up and do away with, disband the organization, and I was going to blast you. But now I don't have to.
Sir.
I feel better.
We're friends, Dave.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I want to let you know that.
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, Representative Escobar, and everyone else on the committee. This bill, there has been a lot of discussion about the State Defense Force, and General Hokanson, when he came in as Adjutant General, and you saw that orientation when he first came in a couple of weeks ago, he talked about restructuring the Oregon Military Department, and he has done a lot of that. The State Defense Force is a component of that. In fact, across this nation, there are many states that are looking at the State Defense Force. I was volunteered by General Hokanson to be the state point of contact in a national discussion that is chaired right now with California National Guard. So this is not a function of the State Defense Force going away. I would like to add that we have temporarily, General Hokanson has temporarily suspended the State Defense Force. It is in an inactive state at this point in time. He has produced a memo. We have that memo of record that we could provide for you. That is a function of trying to ensure that we right fit, right mission, right size the Oregon State Defense Force. General Hokanson, and I quote, states in his 29 January letter, "I am temporarily suspending all Oregon State Defense Force activities effective 1 March. The suspension is basically going to continue until no later than November 2015, when he anticipates the completion and review and publication of the new regulation that governs the Oregon State Defense Force. And so there may be other testimonies that follow this. There may not be. But from our standpoint, this bill is about workers' compensation. And if a State Defense Force is on active duty, state active duty, it's OMD, not OEM.
Do you have another question now?
Two follow-ups. One is, I reserve the right to blast you in the future.
Yes, sir.
just in case. That's just kind of a blanket thing. But I do want to clarify, based on the statement you just made, there is an intent to there is not an intent in, what did you say, November of 15?
November of 15 is when the regulation and the new role of the Oregon State Defense Force will come out in its regulation. Yes, sir.
And there is no intent to do away with or disband.
There is no intent to do away with, disband, or change or eliminate the Oregon State Defense Force. And that would include anything in terms of changing Oregon Statute 399.035. There is no intent to do that.
One more follow-up.
Certainly.
So then what is being considered now for the Defense Force, what their authority would be or how they would be used, or what's being considered?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, this is all about what they're going to be used for. We don't know. We're trying to reshape this role and this mission. What they were used in the past in a number of different capacities, in terms of HAM, in terms of county LNOs, and some other emergency management functions. The reality is we don't know what the new role is going to be or what the new fit of the Oregon State Defense Force is going to look like. And that's what this suspension and this look is supposed to be a part of. This is why I'm also on this at least West Coast initiative with the state of California and the California National Guard to look at how we're structuring the State Defense Force.
Representative Escobar, did you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, but why are we suspending it if it was functional before on up until November 15th? That doesn't even make sense.
So, Chair Lively.
You have suspended it.
Chair Lively, Representative Escobar, there was no relation between this bill. This bill originally was talking about quality service,
that,
quality emergency
Dave, that
services.
That isn't what I asked.
Sir.
I asked, why did you suspend it between now when it was all of a sudden, 1st of March, it's not any good, and prior to that it was okay, until November 15th, then it's going to be okay? I mean, I'm not following your logic.
Chair Lively, Representative Escobar, what General Hokanson's intent was behind the State Defense Force and the suspension of this was to determine whether what it was that the State Defense Force needed to look like and be a part of. There was a lot of different functions that the State Defense Force composition. We could sit there and debate that it was former military members. It was not former military members. It had different roles and functions. And what General Hokanson was trying to say in his letter, and what he's saying here is we got to figure out what it is the scope of the State Defense Force needs to look like. What are the qualifications? Is this a previous National Guard member? Is this a previous anybody member? And so we had a lot of different activities and people inside the State Defense Force. And he's going, I want to pause and be able to look at that and then move forward in November. There's still no intent to get rid of the State Defense Force. He just wants to make certain that whatever we reshape it as and whatever it does is appropriate for the mission and the right size of the Oregon Guard. And we don't know what that is yet.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that there's no reason to suspend it. Mm-hmm. If it was functional before, there's no reason to suspend it now. You can change it in November, but it can still be functional like it is now, and it has been in the past.
Chair Lively, Representative Escobar, from the standpoint of function and what it looked like.
But I don't know if it's functional or not. I don't. You know, that isn't what I'm saying.
I think there would be a discussion on its functionality and its composition and what it was capable of doing. And there are lots of changes that occurred within the Oregon Military Department, not just in the State Defense Force. And that's why this pause is occurring, to ensure that we make certain that whatever it reshaped as is there. Because I attended the 28th February, one of the last training events that was there. And there were to a T, all of them were good-hearted and people that wanted to be a part of a process and a volunteer system.
Yes.
Are they mostly volunteers?
They're all volunteers.
Okay.
They're not a federal force.
So, nice message.
Okay. So, Representative Evans.
Yeah. Oh, let it jump the queue. Go ahead.
No. Sorry, we were ahead already. Representative Parrish. Sorry, that's my mistake.
My question.
Go right ahead. You could ask.
He's got a laundry list, so my list is shorter.
I only have two questions. Honestly. Not a laundry list.
Just a long question.
Yes, sir. No subsets.
We're only
going to
go
basic.
Two questions.
So, Dave, I just want to go back to the original bill because I'm confused.
Thank you.
I didn't, and I don't have a dog in this hunt because if my husband somehow got volunteered for State Defense Force, I've been told really clearly. He's not volunteering right now, so I have no dog in this. However, I did not read the bill to be a workers' comp issue bill. Oh. And if everybody's a volunteer, then they're not covered under workers' comp anyway. So what in the statute is leading the military department to believe that, you know, there is a workers' comp issue given that everybody's a volunteer and they wouldn't be qualified under workers' comp? Like that, I'm not tracking that, and I'm a pretty good bill reader.
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, from the background standpoint, State Defense Force was entered into the Qualified Emergency Services Volunteer Component under 401 because of what occurred out of the 2007 floods and the fact that there's this law commission that discussed who is covering volunteers across this state. If you go to that statute, you read those origins, OEM is. What we're saying in this bill is the State Defense Force is a part of OMD, is a subordinate agency to OMD, just like OEM is. If we call State Defense Force volunteers to state active duty, they're going to be covered under the OMD workers' compensation coverage through SAFE. they don't need to be rolled up under an umbrella of a subordinate agency, OEM, which is also subordinate to OMD. So that's the issue here. They didn't need to be under OEM to begin with for liability purposes, because when they get called to state active duty, they're under OMD already. And that's what we're trying to do here, is clarify this from a housekeeping standpoint, that when the state defense force gets called to state active duty, if there's an injury and they're on duty and there's an injury, that those worker comp actions, if they're injured, are under OMD and OMD's responsibility, not OEM's. All other volunteers still have a process through Qualified Emergency Services Volunteer within the 401 that covers the emergency component that OEM has to manage throughout the state.
Okay. Are you going to ask questions that clears this up, Representative Evans?
Go ahead and ask your questions. I might bounce back.
Okay.
I don't know if it clears it, but it does add color and context. I was a part of the task force discussions about the volunteerism, because there, at that point there were concerns about firefighters in California not wanting to come into Oregon because our workers' comp was not the same. So I kind of understand the threat of wanting to make sure that the workers' comp stuff is clear. My concern, however, goes back to something that may, quite frankly, not be in the bill, but in reality is what we have. And so my first question is, in this remaking of the State Defense Force, how much communication is going on between the TAG and the folks that were the State Defense Force? That's the first question. And the second one is, going back to Representative Escobar's question, every night I go to bed wondering and hoping that we don't have a 9.0, and I guess I'm trying to figure out how is it better to have nothing than have something? Because in the 07-08 storms, they served a very important function, at least in the EOCs and other things. So those are two questions I have.
Chair Lively, Representative Evans. Second question, in terms of the National Guard, there's still a component where they have a regional responsibility to support the EOCs. And so in 2007, I was the operations officer for the Oregon National Guard. And in some cases, there was an Oregon State Defense Force person and a National Guard soldier in the same EOC. And all we're simply saying is if we had an emergency today and you went to bed and woke up because it was shaking, there's still a structure for both OEM to have its regional responsibilities to EOCs within the counties, and then the Guard, too. And so the National Guard, 2162, Mid-Willamette Valley, Eugene, Springfield, located in Springfield, they have counties assigned to them. And so Lieutenant Colonel San Miguel out there will go out there and coordinate, and there will be a guard person that they will assign to those EOCs. And so from the coverage of the EOC and what exists for the emergency manager and support those counties, the guard's still going to be there.
Yeah, okay, follow up on that.
No, go ahead.
Yes, there will be a body there and someone wearing a good uniform and everything. But again, my concern is 07-08. It was the relationships of guys and gals that have been training with those EOCs that made a difference. And even as late as 2012 in Vigilant Guard, we were still using State Defense Force folks in what that exercise. So I'm just a little bit cautious or concerned, I guess, about when we have National Guard assets being deployed relatively routinely still, how we're relying upon those folks to double duty in a way. Because their job right now is training to go to war in addition to other stuff. And why we don't still benefit from having a State Defense Force person in the OC. But that's, again, just a question.
Yeah, Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, this still goes back to the role of, correction, Representative Evans, apologies. This still goes back to whatever the future role is going to look like for the State Defense Force. As it applies to this bill, this is still about workers' comp and coverage and who's covering it when they're on active duty. In terms of the role of the State Defense Force and what they're going to look like, they very well may be, it may turn out to be a continuation of what they did before. It may not. I don't know. And that goes back to your first question when you asked about the engagement process. So on 28 February, I was talking to the State Defense Force. We have not re-engaged with them less than a month later to start talking about the partnership in which we're going to figure out what that role or responsibility is going to look like. We do have a few months, and right now, for the last 3 weeks, I've not done that. We intend to do that in the future.
Okay.
Representative Parrish.
Okay, so I'm going to go back now that I've half-baked my question here. So I'm in the ORS 401 3.358, looking at this right now, because I appreciate where you're trying to get to, and if we need to have people properly categorized in somewhere in statute, I don't think this bill reads that way, folks. And I'm still have a little bit of heartburn with it, just because, you know, the summary says removes members of the Oregon State Defense Force, yada yada, and in fact, when you go down line 17, clearly there's a deletion there, and I think that's what's giving people heartburn. But I actually worried about that, given when you read the actual 401358 and look at it, I mean, it really clearly is talking about, like, that we're training people under a public body. And so are you saying that if we delete those folks from this statute, I mean, currently the current work of the State Defense Force reads like it fits here, and I'm not sure where under another existing statute, because the bill is silent on that, where we actually wind up putting them in a way that still recognizes that they're training with a public body, and that the training's been approved by the public body, and that the purpose of preparing them is for qualified emergency service volunteers to be able to perform those emergency services. So if they don't live here, where is the statute that we wind up putting folks? Like, I'm not seeing that. Yeah. So, and it's not
Chair,
in the bill.
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, they live in 399.035.
Okay.
And so the statute that we're removing them from, 401.358, there are hundreds of different volunteer organizations throughout this state, CERT, et cetera. This bill, or this portion of the language in 401, in OEM's portion of statute, is talking about the infrastructure of creating the volunteer system. As it applies to the State Defense Force, they're already in 399.035. They're already under the responsibility of the Adjutant General, with regulations and responsibilities and authorities and training and duties and everything. And that's what the State Defense Force resides in now. There's nothing in this bill that talks about removing the State Defense Force out of 399.035. They will still live there and continue in some form or fashion. This is all about removing the State Defense Force out of OEM's responsibilities, which is almost like a parallel office with underneath the Oregon Military Department.
The follow-up on that is, now I'm in 399.035, and not seeing where, if this bill's about workers' comp, I just want to get back to where we started. The bill's about workers' comp. This 399.035 doesn't show me anything in the statutes that says that they would be covered under workers' comp, then moving over to the military department. If that's so, where does that, how does that happen? Because that this 399.035 is silent on that, and there's no subsequent reference to how we take care of those folks. And I guess where I'm sort of going with this is, in 2011, we had a bill in the healthcare committee that dealt with people who used to have a professional license, say they were a doctor or a nurse or whatever, and for the purpose of emergency management, or you had, you know, quake or whatever, that under certain conditions, we would suspend the fact that they don't have a current active license, because we need all boots on the ground to take care of healthcare. And we looked at, in that particular instance, said, you know, a little bit flip difference in that we said, well, we're going to waive any liability, you know, if you weren't using the most current technique and you accidentally harmed somebody, like, we were going to waive liability, because we recognized the need for that volunteer force. And I'm not sure if those folks got covered under workers' comp, but this does not say here that they are, this group is covered. So is the intent to not have them be covered under workers' comp? But because the statute doesn't say that they would have a worker comp, if the bill's really simply about workers' comp.
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, 399.035, the Adjutant General still has authority and responsibilities to promulgate rules and regulations within the Oregon National Guard. One of those is going to be the regulation 10-2 that covers the State Defense Force. And so if a State Defense Force member was called to state active duty, it is an order. It is a written order, very similar to an order to active duty like Mark Parrish had in the past. And when he is called to that duty, that responsibility, to this duty location for these days, then he now falls under the responsibility of the Oregon Military Department that is ordering him to do that under state active duty. And so 399.035, what we'll talk about, the Oregon State Defense Force still exists in terms of the duties and responsibilities and the liability that exists within that person. They're not going to be any different than any other guardsman. So if we had a National Guardsman right now today and we needed to call them to state active duty, and they're Title 32 now, and we're putting them on state active duty orders, it's the same exact process. It's the same exact coverage that would fall because they're still state active duty. We have basic three types of functions or roles within the big force. We have Title 10 when they go off to fight in the sandbox across the sea, overseas. Then we have Title 32 inside CONUS, and then we have state active duty. They're on state active duty. It's an order. It says this is what their responsibility, this is what they need to do, and this is what the coverage is.
Follow up on that. But when somebody like Mark Parrish gets called up and he was active at the time or he was on the payroll, he was already covered under workers' comp. So I guess what I'm asking is if they shift over to the Oregon Military Department and then they're activated and they're volunteers, they're not being paid. They're not getting extending federal any benefits earned or any of those kind of things. So I guess I would just like to see something that is a little more clear that if we're going to shift people over here, we fully outline sort of our obligation to our volunteers if they are activated. And that is in this current statute, and I appreciate that y'all can do that through administrative rule, but I've also served on committees outside of this one where the administrative rule process does not come back looking like we thought it was going to come back. I would actually like to see in this bill that we clarify that in statute if we're going to make that kind of shift.
Representative Huffman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think along the lines of Representative Parrish, virtually every session we've come in here and we've had a bill that one year it was skiers back in 08 or 09 because of volunteers, and then the next session we had another one that we were giving some protection against them having to pay workman's comp on volunteers, et cetera, and minimum wage. We've dealt with a variety of things around that. But if I could go back to the suspension part of it, typically, and if you're not at liberty to say or whatever, but typically a program is suspended because something happens and you're going, whoa, we need to take a timeout and correct this, and because of that incident, was there an incident that happened that caused TAG to say, okay, time out?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, the State Defense Force had, there wasn't necessarily a specific incident. It was just a function of what is it that we needed the State Defense Force to look like across in the future. So there were leaders that were a part of the State Defense Force in the past. There will certainly be leaders in the future. And so from our standpoint, we just wanted to make certain that whatever it was that the State Defense Force was doing, it met the needs and requirements of today's environment. And that was really the structure.
Just closing comment. Okay. It's kind of an apples and oranges comparison, but probably a year and a half or so ago, I got a call from a constituent that's a part owner of a business that she's an esthetician. And the health licensing board was getting ready to put out a cease and desist against all estheticians and businesses in the state for 180 days. In a lot of these cases, there was hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars in business expenses on equipment, locations, real estate, et cetera, and so on. And they were going to be forced to cease operation for 180 days to the health licensing board, figured out the rules around that and what might change. I fought strongly against that, and Representative Hoyle and I we've chief sponsored a bill. Fortunately, they were, common sense took over, and they were allowed to continue operations while we got a bill ready. In this session, we're going to be passing a bill to do that. Dave, I think what you're hearing is loud and clear. I think many of us are like, why would you suspend something while the rules are written around bringing it into the new century or whatever? So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stuckey. So what I just suggest, so we have other people who would like to testify and like to hear that testimony, then we can decide. There's obviously, from the committee standpoint, there's some concerns, there's some things that were expressed that we didn't know before we started. And there may be a process in addition to this that we can get some answers to those before we would want to move with the bill. So I'd like to hear from the other witnesses, and then we can decide Certainly. After we've heard that testimony, just to All be right. fair. Thank you, Thank Mr. Stuckey. Okay, so I'm going to call on Mr. Fred Broadwater. Water. Yes, it is Broadwater, and I know that. Thank you. Let's see, John O'Connor. And is it David?
Nelson.
Okay, you want to come up to the... And again, before you speak, just identify yourself for the record, please.
Roger that, sir. Chair Lively, my name is... Fred Broadwater. I'm a native Oregonian, and I was a member of the Oregon State Defense Force. Taking my time with the Oregon State Defense Force and my time with the Oregon Army National Guard, I computed out that I've got 39 years, 6 months, and 12 days in boots in service to the state of Oregon. And I don't know all the answers, and I don't know all the questions, but what I've got is I brought 4 subject matter experts with me, and they've all been tasked with a little slice. And so with that, I'm going to lead off with Colonel John O'Connor, and so John, introduce yourself and go for it.
I'm Colonel retired John O'Connor, Oregon State Defense Force, also retired from the California Army National Guard. So I'm Oregon immigrant.
We don't hold it against
Yeah. you. I want to take a few minutes to tell you where the Oregon State Defense Force came from.
Move the mic back a little because it gets remote. Thank you.
Where the Oregon State Force came from and where it is now. The original 13 colonies had militias, state militias for defense, mainly because there wasn't much of a Continental Army. And therefore, when the Constitution was written in 1787, Article 1 specified that the states have the right to form their own state militias for defense. Commonly known as the Ultimate Guardians of Liberty, up to now. During the Civil War, most of the Union forces were from state militias. You've probably heard of some of them, 20th Maine, 54th Massachusetts. Yep. So these are really the backbone of the Union Army until finally the Union Army was big enough under... General Grant. In 1917, they passed the Home Defense Act. This authorized home defense forces to provide internal security when all the state National Guards went off to France in World War I. So they took their place, if you will. And a total of approximately 100,000 home defense forces, troops, were on state active duty for their states. After the armistice, they were disbanded. In 1940, Congress could see the war clouds coming in Europe, so they authorized in peacetime to authorize state guards. This first time you heard the word state guards. And they were authorized and called up because they knew there was going to be a war. And during the war, during the duration, state guards were responsible for a lot of internal security responsibilities, particularly guarding bridges, guarding railroads, war plants, harbors. This way, federal troops were freed to do other responsibilities. Now, Congress, in 1955, they authorized, in concrete, state defense forces. At that time, the Army developed what was called a total force concept, and that is where National Guard units, Army Reserve units, would be part of the active Army in any deployments. And we know that, particularly Oregon, they're involved in Iraq, Afghanistan as part of this total force concept. Finally, in 1983, the Defense Act was passed, and for the first time, it authorized all states to maintain permanent, not just for a war, but permanent state defense forces. Following that, part of that was the National Guard Bureau enacted their National Guard Regulation 10-4 that authorized state defense forces to jointly train, not separately, but jointly train with National Guard units. And this is going on today. For example, we have our headquarters at Camp Withycombe, and in the past we've had training at Camp Raleigh. Now the final one was Title 32. When you talk about Title 3rd U.S. Code, this is the heavyweight stuff. And in 2013, Section 109 of this code was passed, and it defined specifically for the state forces, state defense forces. State service. Now, that just what it means. It means state service, not leaving the state, not going federalized, but state service for homeland defense and emergency preparedness. The state defense forces would support the National Guard as force multipliers, but still not leaving the state. And in this case, the state defense force personnel would not receive pay or any benefits. We buy our own uniforms. We pay our own mileage. So that's what it was in 1787. All the colonists bought their own guns, their own uniforms and everything, and we're doing the same thing today. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Nope, I'm next.
Oh, you're next, sorry.
I'm next. I'm going to give you a history lesson of the state of Oregon. I talked to numerous people over the years, and I will have to tell you that the Oregon State Defense Force is Oregon's best kept secret. Very few people have heard of it. People on this committee had never heard of the State Defense Force. People who ran for governor last year had never heard of the State Defense Force. Let me get into the lineage. May 2nd, 1842, at Shampooey, four officers were appointed to the Oregon State Defense Force, actually to the Oregon Militia, a major and three captains. You're going to hear some familiar names here. March 9th, 1844, the formation of 25 mounted riflemen under a Captain T.D. Kaiser. Familiar name. Oregon was admitted to the Union in 1849, February 14. In October 1, 1942, the State Guard grew to 433 officers, one warrant officer, and 8,158 enlisted men. That was what was in the state in 1942. 45 to 50, not much happened. The Korean War was in June of 1950 to June 27 of 53 when an armistice was signed. However, there is still no peace treaty today. Technically, the United States is still at war with Korea. Governor Mark O. Hatfield ordered Major General Alfred Heintz to recreate the Home Guard, as it was called then. In September 16, 1961, the fourth version of the State Guard was born, commanded by Brigadier General Edward C. Snow. Cadre strength was set at 146 officers, 27 warrant officers, and 10 enlisted men, for a total of 183. I'm reminded of the statement kind of Winston Churchill made, "Never have so few been commanded by so many." In 1962, the mission was given to the State Defense Force is to augment the National Guard as an internal security police or internal security force during the time of peace and to replace the National Guard in the state service when the National Guard is called into federal service. Those were the days when they figured, well, activate the Guard, they all go away, who's going to be here to protect the state and to do those state jobs? Governor Hatfield increased the strength on October 25th, 1962 to 567 personnel, which was almost a 30% increase. And that was comprised of 266 officers, 27 warrant officers, and 274 enlisted men. And when I enlisted in the Oregon Army National Guard, I started out as a private E-1. Governor McCall increased the size by 20% to 680 in January of 1968. A new unit was added in 1971 to the Oregon State Defense Force, the Oregon National Guard Pipe Band. And the Oregon Army National, or the Oregon National Guard Pipe Band represented the 11 western states at President Reagan's inaugural parade in 1981. Another major reorganization occurred with a cadre strength of 12,040 personnel, which was a growth of 82%, in May of 1983. All this is before me. And then during 1989, the legislature changed the name from the Oregon National Guard Reserve to the Oregon State Defense Force. It was reorganized again in 2002 under Brigadier General Rendy, and the authorized strength was 205. And that's what it stands today, with an authorized strength of 205. And the last numbers I have access to from August of last year were that it had about 122 members. So that's the lineage, if you will, of the Oregon State Defense Force. And I bore you with a history lesson. It wasn't my favorite subject in high school or college, but I do believe that if you don't study it, you're going to have some problems. Now, for training, you've got another page with lots of room to write notes if you care. But in keeping with the implied mission of emergency assistance to 36 counties in the state, the State Defense Force was tasked by Lieutenant Colonel Bud Jones, who at that time was the director of MSCA, Military Support to Civil Authorities, and he wanted a liaison program created so that people had some standards when they went out to those 36 counties around the state and weren't just 36 different applications. So we developed an 8-hour course, and it was vetted by him and his staff officers. And to date, we have presented that course to Oregon National Guardsmen, to Oregon Air Guardsmen. We've had a couple of Coast Guard guys come through, and the State Defense Force. And this is in addition to FEMA training that is required, which allows the State Defense Force to be that force multiplier for the National Guard. The FEMA courses that are required are ICS 700, the National Incident Management System, NIMS, and Introduction, ICS 100, Introduction to Incident Command System, ICS 200, which is ICS for single resources and initial action incidents. That would cover a traffic accident, incident. Something a little bigger is going to require more assets. Those three courses are all that the National Guard requires in the state of Oregon. The State Defense Force, I was the training officer when we did this, and I said, well, I think we ought to have ICS 800, which is the National Response Framework and Introduction, ICS 230, which is Fundamentals of Emergency Management, and then the big nut was ICS 300 and 400, and that's intermediate ICS for expanding incidents and advanced ICS, Command and General Staff, and complex incidents. And the rationale for that was, by the time the Guard gets involved or the State Defense Force gets involved, it's bigger than a traffic accident, or it's bigger than a tanker truck falling into the Columbia. To take all the FEMA courses that the State Defense Force requires is about 60 hours of personal time. Now, I've got a bullet point: exercise participation. The State Defense Force participated in tip-off in 2006, and we were the only people in boots at tip-off. We participated in top-off in October of 2007, which was a federal bit. There were National Guardsmen sitting right next to State Defense Force personnel. But the National Guardsmen had never been in the building before and didn't know any of the players. I'm going to digress for a moment. I sat in a committee meeting in Portland in August of last year, and the police chief of Troutdale was leading a panel discussion on the active shooter incident at Reynolds High School. And his comment was, when you're in the middle of the event, you don't want somebody walking up to you with a business card and saying, "Hi, I'm your support." You want to have that relationship established long before then. We participated in QuakeX in June of 2008. We participated in Cascadia Apparel in December of 2009. In actual events, the State Defense Force was active in the Vernonia flood December 3 through 10, 2007. Matter of fact, were it not for one of our communications guys, the jock at the Readiness Center wouldn't know what was going on at the Columbia County Emergency Operations Center. We did have someone working the Almsville tornado on December 14th, 2010, only because he happened to be a member of the State Defense Force and he was the chief of police for Almsville. So I guess we can say we had somebody there. So those are the actual events we've participated in. Questions of me?
We've had one more testimony. So what I'd like to say, and I respect all of this, so we have about 10 more minutes. We can have testimony in this. We have other business we have to conduct today. And just remind people that this hearing is about House Bill, about the specific bill, and I appreciate the background and the purpose for having that.
Right.
But so we've got about 10 more minutes, and you can decide. We've got several more people who want to testify, and I just need to understand how we get through that is all.
Well, the question I would ask you, sir, is do you want to know any of the capabilities or limitations of the State Defense Force?
And all of that's very good information. It's not necessarily germane to the bill that we're considering.
I understand.
And so I apologize, that just happens to be the way that is. Then that's not the bill. This doesn't mean we wouldn't come back another time and have those conversations. But right now, the specific hearing is on this bill.
Well, here's part and parcel with that. Mr. Stuckey, Colonel Stuckey, Dave and I go back a few years, but he is absolutely right when he came up and said he had a meeting with the State Defense Force in February of this year. At that point in time, I don't think I would use the word talk. I think I would use the word order. Okay. They were ordered out of the building, and everybody was given their military records jacket. And if you're going to suspend an organization, that's a good way to do it, is to disband it and give everybody their 201 file and let them go out the door. It's going to be very difficult to rebuild it after that, which is what happened.
And I appreciate that and understand. I'm not questioning what you're saying. And again, I think what we learned up here, there's some other discussions that we need to have about that, what that particular is. But again, that's not this particular bill.
I understand that, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody got a question? Or
anybody have any
just
questions?
Sit down and shut up.
Oh, but thank you.
Mike Valdez once told me, be bright, be brief, and be gone.
But thank you for taking the time.
You
sir.
Bet.
Chairman Lively.
When you scoot the microphone over, please, so they, it can be recorded. Okay, you can scoot over then. Thank you.
Chairman Lively, board. My name is Dave Nelson, and I was going to be talking to give you a background about what the State Defense Force has been since Rende in 2001 to February 28th of this year. And basically, what I was going to talk about is the fact that the organization has people like myself who are professional engineers who have, of course, past military experience. I was in Korea at K2 1952-53, left as an angry young man because of the way that people were slaughtered. I came into the State Defense Force after 9/11, have been in it ever since, provided engineering support through the system, and that's what our organization is, and comms, which followed later, the same deal. I appreciate very much for having the opportunity to hear this today, and thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time, and I would just let people know that so all of the written testimony, I don't think it was on OLIS before, but everything that was submitted will become part of the record, so it will be on the, in OLIS so that people can recognize that too, and it'll be available for others, but thank you very much for coming. So next we have James Myers.
Chair Lively and committee, I'll make this brief. My name is James Myers. I served in the Oregon State Defense Force and served with the Oregon Military Department. And my experience in the Joint Operations Center working for the State Defense Force was a positive experience. As of December of 2015, we had 106 State Defense Force members. Of that, 67 or 68 were ham radio operators. Mm. Of that, 37 were MARS members. MARS meaning Military Auxiliary Radio Service. Mm. My last position within the State Force was as Deputy Chief of Staff in charge of signal. And you have my written presentation. I won't take up any more of your time unless
you.
Anyone has a question.
Anybody have any questions? Thank you for given the testimony.
No problem.
Submitted. So how about David Talbot?
So, does my, yes, okay. Just this was just the order for that.
Thank you for the opportunity. Dave Talbot, been in the State Defense Force for about 5 years. Prior Alaska National Guard, prior active duty military, Vietnam combat pilot. And I can say it's been one of the best experiences I've had in my life. I'm we're suspended, of course, but was the commander of the 162 down in Eugene, Springfield. And as the colonel mentioned, all the training that we go through comes right down to the front lines. It's relationships. We develop relationships. The unit I was in, we were responsible for five counties, Lynn, Benton, Lane, Polk, and Marion County. And one of my duties that I took very seriously is we made ourselves well known to all the EOC or ECC commanders or the people that ran these operation centers, so that we had a working firsthand relationship with them on a monthly basis by going to these meetings, letting them know what we were doing, how we could support them. We never go into one of these EOCs to take over. We go in to assist. We become the eyes and ears for the Guard. Never do we take control. We're there to help and assist. So I'm very proud to be a member of the State Defense Force, and I really think we've got quite a legacy. You've all, and I will end with one thing. We've all heard about there are, you know, old soldiers just die and fade away. That's not true. They join the State Defense Force. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mike Caldwell.
I've seen this guy
before. I think we have seen him before.
Yes, indeed.
Welcome.
Chairman, members of the committee, pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm Mike Caldwell. I live in South Salem, and I live in Representative Paul Evans' House District.
Okay.
I can understand where Dave Stuckey's coming from with respect to his liabilities, which is reportedly what this is. And Representative Perry, she mentioned that you were looking in the ORS under 396.330. Sub 2, it basically says that anybody put on state active duty becomes a temporary employee of the military department, which then immediately puts them in a position where they are covered under state accident insurance. When I was the deputy, when I had Dave's job, we had issues with our safe rates because we were incurring so many injuries on forest fires and state active duty, et cetera. So we went to SAFE, and we separated out state active duty from the regular employee base because it was driving our rates out the roof. And so we separated that out to make that distinction. I don't know if that's still going on or not. It's been 2 years since I've had anything to do with it. But that was the whole intent and purpose of that. Now, I can understand what he's trying to do is make it clear under the emergency management statutes that it isn't, but it's already covered under 396.330. So I don't think there's any definition, any argument on the definition. It's clear. So that would suffice it. But if he wants to clean up the statutes, then probably that's exactly what should happen. In this case, it became a referendum on the discussion. It became a referendum on the State Defense Force and its merits and values. And I think is my two cents, I think it's very meritorious. And I think the Adjutant General ought to reconsider suspension. But that's his choice. I'm not the Adjutant General. He is. But it's done a world of good for the citizens of the state of Oregon. And in many cases, were instrumental in saving lives in 2007. As Representative Boone may recall, during the massive windstorms over in the North Coast, had it not been for their ham radio capability, frankly, we probably would have, somebody would have been in worse shape. I won't say they would have perished, but they could have. But they were very instrumental in that particular exercise or that emergency. So I think they're well valued outside the military department. Let's put it that way. Unfortunately, this current regime doesn't feel that way, and they want to reassess it. We did reassess it. General Reese and I did in 2006. That's when we came up with the liaison issues that we came up with that basically became their mission. What we found was that so many people were training active guardsmen were training to go to war, which is their mission. If you look at their budget, it's 98-99% paid for by the federal government, and they want them to do their mission, not the states. Mm. We'd have an emergency, and suddenly the last lieutenant in the Armory would be told to go to the county courthouse to be the liaison for the EOC. And that lieutenant would say, where's the courthouse? Which is not a good practice to have. So we reshaped it in 2006. This law we changed, by the way, in 2003 in order to make that change to get it covered. But if Dave wants to clean up his statutes, I can understand why he'd want to do that. With that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thanks for taking the time to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak on whatever we're at? House Bill 2428.
John, I've got to go. Can we pause for just a second and work these bills?
Okay. So we're going to...
Beg your indulgence.
No, that's all right. We have a member that has to leave, and we have a couple of bills to work, and then we'll come back and finish up with this. So I'm closed right now for the public hearing for House Bill 2428, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2892. Would you like to remind us of what House Bill 2892 is?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2892 requires procurement display of National League of Families POW/MIA flag on all state buildings, county courthouses with existing flagpoles year-round. Just briefly, the issues discussed last when the committee met on 5 March was the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency and their ongoing mission, the 98 Oregonians that are still missing and unaccounted for, and some of the revised statutes and similar legislation in other states. There is a proposed -1 amendment for you that clarifies some of the language about infrastructure for flagpoles. We have the fiscal and we have the revenue statement. There's no subsequent referral.
Mr. Chair, I think they think it's over.
Yeah, it's yeah. It's not over yet. Well, if you want to,
we're
going
to reopen it. We have business we have to conduct, and we have to be out of here at 2:45.
They're going to reopen the hearing. Just a second.
But she has to leave, and we won't have the vote. The members to vote. So I'm sorry, that's just the process we have to go through. So, you understand the amendment, and you're fine with that?
Yeah, I'm fine. Okay. Well, in fact, they're my amendment.
I thought they probably were.
Okay. They're mighty fine amendments.
Yeah, mighty fine amendments.
I don't understand them, John. Would you explain them?
You have a problem?
Okay. Representative Boone.
Chair Lively, I move to adopt the -1 amendment dated 2/16/2015.
Representative Boone moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated 2/16/2015. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Okay. No objections. The -1 amendments are adopted.
Chair Lively, I move House Bill 2892 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2892 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Okay.
Well.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative
Paluso?
Aye.
And Chair Lively?
Aye. Motion passes, and I assume, Representative Esquivel, you'll carry the bill?
I'd be honored.
Okay. Very good. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 2892, open the work session on House Bill 2270. Oh, sorry.
That's right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2270 is the creating the Office of State Resiliency Officer in the Office of the Governor. We met on March 3rd and again today on the 19th. Issues discussed, this is the top recommendation from the Oregon Resiliency Task Force. There's no revenue impact. You have the fiscal impact before you, and this measure has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Boone.
Chair Lively, Chair Lively, I move House Bill 2270 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2270 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to let the committee know I did meet with Governor Brown this week and told her about this, and so she wouldn't be shocked. And she took lots of notes, and we talked about it, and I had been preceded in my meeting by General Hokanson. So I was, he kind of spread the good red carpet for me. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Nice volume.
Representative
Paluso?
Aye.
Chair Lively? Aye. Motion.
Mr. Chair, you
passes.
Can tell they were Army.
That's right.
Chair
thank
Lively,
you.
Thank you. I have to, excuse me, I've got to go. I'm getting ready to co-chair a domestic violence work group this weekend.
Well, that's fine. Thank you. Representative Parrish.
As this topic.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a few more minutes. So
I think Cindy went out to get.
Is he?
Is he coming back?
Or is lack of?
There's one. But there's one.
Something's up.
Okay. So we have about 6 more minutes. So I'll,
thank
at
you,
this
Cindy.
Point, I'll reopen the hearing on House Bill 2428. And if there's anybody else, so just identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm Command Sergeant Major Jose Busto, retired United States Army. For your information, I retired with 30 years, two tours in Vietnam, and 2 years during Desert Storm. Then I retired in 98. And I was recruited to the Oregon Defense Force about 5 years ago. And I do not understand what he was talking about, that, you know, he's not demobilizing the force, which is written demobilizing. It takes a good year to have a kind of a decent personnel in the Oregon Defense Force to run radios and being a liaison and to disband the Oregon Defense Force, all these people gonna disappear. And if you're gonna start recruiting, it's gonna take some time into 2017 that we have a liable force. And the thing that he was talking about, I'm a member of the EMAC right here in Marion County, and in different positions, because I'm a cert supervisor for Mount Angel, which is Marion County, and I've been involved with them for over about 4 years. In 4 years, I never seen one single Army guard in the meeting or connecting relationship with the director. We have a brand new director. He didn't even know that he was supposed to have a liaison from the Oregon Guard at his EMAC meeting. And he's a retired colonel from the Army. That means we connected. And I told him, I says, you need to find out. Anyway, we done a lot of good. I was a command sergeant major for the 82nd Regiment, which is composed of LaGrand, Ben, and our headquarters in Camp Withicum. And Ben, when we started 2 years ago, their radios weren't even functioning. They didn't even have a liable antenna to transmit to Redmond. And we went and put up a brand new antenna, fixed the radio, and they start communicating and teaching the personnel how to run their radios, not ours, but their military radios. That means somebody can come and say that we are not liable for the National Guard. You know, there's smoking something than cigar, but I just wanted you to know, because I can stand listening to this guy, and his nose was growing rapidly. But anyway, please, if you have any questions of me.
Question? Doesn't look like it, but thank you very much for testifying, for your service, prior service, and your current service in the force. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. State your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Eric Colson. Representative Evans, I'm sure, recognizes me. I was not planning on providing any testimony, so I came a little unprepared, so I'm kind of speaking off the cuff. 9 p.m. January 26, 1700, we had a major rupture of the Cascadia subduction zone off the coast. Damage estimates even to this day are still unknown. 2004, we had a major earthquake in Indonesia. The result was somewhere in the neighborhood of 280,000 dead. And in 2011, we had a major earthquake off the coast of Japan, 15,000 dead. In the Indonesia and the Japanese earthquake share one thing significant in common, and that is that their communication systems were completely gone. Any cell phone towers that remained viable were so plugged up with calls they were majorly useless. The landlines were either too full to be used or severed and disrupted. So what happened is volunteer ham radio operators stepped in to fill the void. There's an article I read of a ham radio operator in Indonesia who refused to leave his radio for fear that somebody might go unhelped. He wound up dying from the exhaustion of having spent more than 36 hours straight on his radio. That is documented. The Oregon State Defense Force has worked diligently in setting up communications networks, communications training. I think you will find yourselves hard-pressed to find anybody that has put more effort into developing the communications capabilities of the State Defense Force than myself. Our mission at one point was to go into the EOCs and provide much-needed radio communications to maintain lines of communications with units outside of the EOC. This is, some think, in conflict with what ARIES does. Well, what we were doing, what our mission was, were to be liaisons to the military department, so the military department, in addition to what's coming in from ARIES, would know what is occurring. I have talked to many people who tell me, well, when the earthquake hits, I'll just get on my cell phone call. Well, I'm sorry, that's not going to happen. Cell phones will be unavailable. We've seen this in significant disasters. Cell phones and landlines are unavailable. The only people that are getting information to those that need to have the information are people operating on ham radios. The Oregon State Defense Force, as you have heard, has worked very diligently on training for ham radios, exercising. We have participated in some fairly significant events. And in the events where we have participated, we have proved our ability to be assets to the emergency management network. So I think that, in my personal opinion, disestablishing or shutting down or temporarily suspending the State Defense Force, if any of you wake up tomorrow and your bed is shaking like crazy, who are you going to call? Ghostbusters aren't going to come in and help you. You're going to have somebody that is qualified and available to provide those communications. And while the State Defense Force is not the only game out there, we are one that has specifically trained for that type of event.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Just want to thank you for what you do. I'm very well aware of everything you did, and Brigadier General Caldwell mentioned it too, and it was the people who could run a ham radio were the heroes of the day.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2428. No further business come before the committee. We're adjourned.
We'll go back right now and update the agenda.
We'll go back.